Yes, hello, folks. Welcome to the weekly Manchester United Pod. I'm your host, as always, Phil Branch, with my regular co-host, the excellent James Rhodes from United Muppeteers. This is a podcast I was not expecting to be recording in this kind of mood today. How you, mate? How was your weekend?
It was good. It was good. And the long weekend over here in the US we've both had now was nice and relaxing, and definitely ended better on Sunday than was hoping to when it comes to United. So obviously good feeling from that.
Yes, it was Thanksgiving here in the States last week. So I spent Monday, went to the Grand Canyon on Monday, and my phone was basically off all week after we recorded because I had no signal. And I have to say, it was really nice to unplug for a few days, just from everything, from life, and just spend time with my kids, and especially with everything that's been going on in the world. Recently, yeah, it was just nice to be able to switch off and spend some really amazing time. And then, of course, this weekend comes, and I wasn't optimistic. On the way back from Arizona, I was driving back, and I was listening to a bunch of different athletic football podcasts. And one of them was, of course, talking in depth about the Everton situation and comparing it, what the difference is between that and City, and how riled up the Everton fans were. And the whole time I'm thinking, you know, United in that type of atmosphere never do well. You know, in a hostile atmosphere where the other team desperately want it, where they're up for it. I always fear for United in an environment like that. I always feel like if they fall behind, it's going to be a nightmare.
Yeah.
They came out, Ten Hag's best ever away win at United, 3-0. And we got to witness something that you'll really only see. You can watch football for 50, 60 years. You'll probably see this 5 or 6 times in your life.
Yep. Yeah, it was pretty spectacular. I mean, it's hard to describe because it is one of those, like, that's a once in a career. What Alejandro Garnacho did, that's once in a career that's going to happen for him. And most players, that's never going to happen in their careers. A goal like that, a hit like that. I mean, there have been very few things over the last few years that have got me on my feet and feeling like I was joking with someone that I was like, I was feeling born again after this goal. as a football fan, after the last few years that we've had of like, sadness, and you know, sitting there, and I'm sitting there on a Sunday morning laying on the couch like, oh man, another game. I know how this is gonna go. I know how this is gonna feel. I couldn't sit down after that. The rest of the game, I just could not sit down. I was like, I was definitely, I think, born again, a good word for it. But it was an incredible goal. What he did was unbelievable. I don't think I've seen a better goal myself in watching football.
You know, James, I've been saying on this podcast for about 5-6 weeks that I felt really disconnected from United, where I was watching games where, you know, I felt like United were getting wins by court order.
Yeah.
There wasn't anything that was particularly entertaining, and my optimism was sapping by the week.
Yeah.
And this is in many ways the insanity of United's season. And how anomalous so many things are. You know, Rasmus Højlund hasn't scored a Premier League goal, but he's top goal scorer in the Champions League. You know, United, most formed team in the Premier League, and felt like United hadn't won a game. Ten Hag gets his biggest away win at United. Onana has joint most clean sheets in the Premier League.
He's not on the touchline for the game either.
Yeah, a month ago, you know, Onana's being slaughtered. Now he's got joint most clean sheets in the Premier League. And you're going, this is just typical. You know, this is one of the probably most boring seasons I've been witnessing since Van Gaal. And then Garnacho does that. And anyone that's ever played football, I don't care if you play with your friends down the park, it doesn't matter, will know how rare that is. You know, and to do that, to have the execution, the technique, to do that against the England goalkeeper, the Premier League, away to Everton, you know, the accuracy, the body shape, everything. I mean, it's just truly sensational. And it's one of those goals that, you know, can often define careers. David Beckham's goal from the halfway line is forever played. You're going to be better than that to me.
Yep.
It's one of those moments where I stood up after it went in. First time I've really, really, in a long time, maybe actually since Garnacho at Arsenal, where I've reacted that way to a goal, where I stood up, I put my hand on my head, I was watching it with my son, and I was genuinely speechless for a second. I'm like, and then of course the profanity and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Watched, you know, and then I screamed the house down. You know, and I couldn't believe what I was watching. To see that, I mean, as soon as he hit it, I'm like, right in the corner. And, you know, obviously the goal is, you know, it's a masterpiece, but it was a really important goal because United could not fall behind in that game.
Yeah, they couldn't. And you could see that, I mean, even right afterwards, at the 10-minute mark, the Everton fans started doing their protest in earnest, right? Holding up the cards along the whole stadium. You had the fireworks going off outside the stadium. You could hear them even through the TV. I mean, I'm sure in the stadium, I don't know how you could hear, if in the stadium you could hear them less or more because of the sound or any of that, but certainly on TV, on the broadcast, you could hear the fireworks going off. And they looked a bit shaky at that point in time.
Yep.
The team looked a bit shaky for about the next 15, 20 minutes. And you're thinking, it's a damn good thing they've got this one goal lead right now. Damn good thing that they got this start right now, because I think it helped keep them together a bit, through all of that, because you could tell the atmosphere was going. And I think that, the Everton players were playing into that. They're being very aggressive. And I do think for once as well, the very interesting thing that happened is I think that was the first correctly officiated game for Manchester United this season. It was really, really well called by the referee, where for once I felt it wasn't biased against United. And that was really important in taking the sting out of the game, because Everton were putting some really rough fouls in, and he wasn't having it. He wasn't just letting it go because of the moment, letting it go because it was United. And I actually thought that was very important in terms of allowing it to be a game that United could compete in and not feel like they were, you know, playing against an extra man. But, go for it.
No, of course, you're absolutely right, because it would have been easy to forgive John Brooks for doing the opposite. You know, feeling the pressure. You know, Everton have, in my opinion, I completely understand their sense of injustice. I mean, to me, it's an absolute farce that you have a team with 115 charges that can drag a court case out for years.
Yep.
And Everton, who, yes, they're guilty, and they were warned numerous times. I mean, like I was saying, I listened to a really detailed podcast on what they did wrong, but they complied. And, what City are accused of is far, far worse, far more complex, obviously, but they're accused of not just not complying, but lying. And you can't have a situation where your runaway Premier League winners are escaping punishment on something far, far greater. And Everton are getting punished. There should have been a statute put in that prevented this from being dragged out for years. There should be a quick resolution to this. And just, I don't want to elaborate too much on that, but for City, you know, the fact that there's question marks over their titles is their own fault, in my opinion. If you want to address that issue, litigate it quickly. And the fact that you're dragging it out means that other fans, and quite rightly, are going to point fingers. And I do wonder what's going to happen if you look at teams that have been relegated that are talking about litigating against Everton.
Yep.
Or teams going to litigate against City. Teams that didn't make the Champions League, all sorts of things. I mean, the potential of that is huge. But anyway, thought United handled the atmosphere well. One of the things that I thought was different was United, instead of getting worse, is the game went on, they improved in the second half. I haven't seen that in so long. John Brooks done a very, very good job refereeing the game. And quite rightly, James, one of the things that I thought also, and we'll get into Cabby Manning and all that in a minute, but a VAR decision went in their favour at a key moment. They go 2-0 up, completely changes the game. Now, United haven't been getting those decisions. What if it doesn't go in the favour? You know, Everton equalise. They could easily win that game from equalising.
Yep.
We have a completely different outcome. These are the things that weren't going for them a month ago. They needed a decision at a key moment in the game to go in their favour, which it did. Rashford took the penalty, took it very well. I'm not sure Ten Hag in the moment was particularly pleased that he took it. Very, very important for Rashford to score that goal. But I thought John Brooks done a really good job. And I think Everton, they may feel aggrieved it was a penalty to me, but also Doucouré could have easily been sent off in that game for a second.
Yeah.
And I think for the first time since watching United, a couple of things went in their favour. And it had a major impact on the outcome of the game.
Yeah, I would agree. And it is it's interesting because you almost feel like the game being reffed correctly was almost, you get a feeling like, is this going in our favor? Like, is this tilted in our favor? Because it's for the first time it's felt like it's equal. But you're right. Ashley Young could have been sent off easily for that penalty. It could have been a second yellow for him.
And I'm glad he wasn't, by the way.
Yeah, me too.
I don't want to see players sent off for that.
No, I think it was all right. Especially Doucouré, I think his first one was for dissent. And so you would think it's rough to get a second one, you know, when he's only made one. So I think it was really fairly officiated. I think it was the type of game that was officiated the way you'd want it to be, where you don't feel an inherent need to change the game as the official and to make yourself the talking point of it. Being as well brave to say on the field, not just missing the penalty, but calling it as a dive the other way and going to the VAR and saying, totally got it wrong. Mm-hmm. We're going to flip it around. Not just that we missed it, but to say, I'm going to change my mind 100%. That's what you need out of the officials, the ability to do that and the want to do that. And, you know, the acceptance to do that instead of trying to stick with what they've called just to, you know, for ego or pride or what have you. I don't know what it is. So I think it was really well done in that respect. And I think that helped a lot. But, you know, those were moments that could change, certainly, because if you don't get that penalty, you don't get that goal. Everton had their own chances. And I think in the first half, we didn't have any outside of the Garnacho goal. Mm-hmm. And so that was a big moment that was very necessary. And I think that when you speak to the team improving as the game went on, I put a couple of things in favor of that. And I think where you saw a bit more of a settled team and a team that grew throughout the game. One of the players I want to highlight in that respect is Luke Shaw returning. Because he's a player who brings a calmness into the team that you're not used to seeing. And I mean, in every respect, and we can talk about Kaby Mainu because he does the same thing. Is when he gets on the ball, it's not like a rocket out of his foot the moment he's on it, where you're scrambling once again because he's going to just shoot it somewhere, pass it somewhere instantly. It's going to go and everybody's going to start scrambling. He'll get on it. He'll move. He'll adjust. He'll take his time. And he brings a calmness to that back line where I think they were far more organized than usual. I think Harry Maguire did a really fantastic job once again of supporting Lindelof against Dominic Calvert-Lewin. That is a specific matchup that Lindelof has struggled with, and I think struggled with again. But Harry Maguire provided a lot of support for him to get in there, to a flawless, again, performance from him in a tough game. And then, you know, Onana continues to grow into it. And I think that it is true that those settled players out the back started to really improve things. Those three in particular, you know, I'd highlight from the back. To settle the team down and grow into the game. And, you know, and I think the other thing that changed, which I think was a correct change, is there was a little bit of a shift in the midfield in the second half in terms of how it was being played that allowed us to have a little bit more possession, a little bit more time on the ball and progress it into better areas. So, you know, it was the right adjustments with the right players in certain circumstances. And it was nice to see that because, it could have gone bad in the first half still. I don't think it was a fantastic performance after the goal. But the second half was about as stress-free as it could get as a United fan this season. And it was just a consistent moving it forward, controlling the game, and getting those goals over time.
I think, you know, we've talked about this on this podcast before, the impact of injuries on how you need to be in the season. And you really notice that when players came back. You notice the difference in composure with United, the quality, the balance. You know, Luke Shaw is such an important player for United. Mm-hmm. They don't have anything that's comparable. Same with Lisandro Martinez, who, when he comes back, will add something that United are missing. But one of the things that I thought was really interesting yesterday, when I have to say, when I saw the lineup, I wasn't particularly optimistic because I'm concerned about Martial's movement up front. And I was thinking, you know, Kobbie Mainoo, is this the right United team you want to bring this kid into? And this is a tough game away from home. I hope you know he doesn't get overrun in midfield, and you know it affects his confidence. And you know, obviously United have enormous injuries. Mason Mount, we'll get to in a minute. The way he played, James, was like finding something that you loved that you'd lost for years. Mm-hmm. You know, it just felt, wow, this is like a warm blanket, because for one of the first times, United weren't bypassing the midfield, knocking the ball along. All of a sudden, you had a kid that could defend with discipline, mm-hmm. was able to play on the half turn, knocking balls into the corners and the channels. You know, United had creativity from depth. The players that can do that for United don't have energy. You know, Christian Eriksen can play deep, but doesn't have the energy. You know, Casemiro can do it, but doesn't have the energy. Kobbie Mainoo had everything. He had the energy. He had the confidence. But think about this. To do that in your first Premier League start, having been out for 4 or 5 months at a very difficult place, at a team that's playing well, a team that presses you, a team that, you know, this isn't Luton at home. You know, this is a very, very difficult game. He added a completely different dimension to United's midfield. And had Garnacho not have scored that goal, everything would be about Kobbie Mainoo. What a sensational full Premier League debut for that kid that filled me with so much hope that this is the Frankie de Jong. This is the player that United really, really, really needed. A player that, when you look at the impact of injuries over the course of a season, that may be the most costly injury that United got this summer. Not the obvious ones, not the Luke Shaw and all that. Kobbie, because he is so transformational for United in how they play, that you're looking at that and going, this kid, you know, he was sensational.
Yeah, he really was. And actually, the player that I was reminded of most of all that United have missed, because I've seen in the past comparisons to Paul Pogba and things like that, but it's not that. It's Nemanja Matic that he reminded me of. Because when Matic, before he got injured in that World Cup, and he would show flashes of it over the next few seasons, but Nemanja Matic, when he came in, even for a year, there was a few points when he was playing where there was an extreme, again, calmness that he would bring to the midfield. Nemanja Matic is one of the, I think, the best dribblers in Premier League history in terms of success. And I'm not talking about like the flashy winger dribbling, but what you see from Kobbie Mainoo, the same thing, what you see from a player like Thiago, you know, in his earlier years, where he'd get on the ball, and this is hugely missing from United, but you get on the ball and there's players around, and it's not frozen, instantly got to send it somewhere, but can turn, can make his own space, can move around, can manipulate the defense, can manipulate the players around him. With all the little movements, the tiny feints, the tiny little things that matter to just open up a gap, open up a channel, press resistance. You know, these are the things that we're talking about that have been missing. And Casemiro, for all of his positives that he brought last year, that is not something he brings to the table either. He's not erratic, but he's very aggressive. You know, he's a very quick, he was a very fast, you know, great making, doing amazing, shielding the defense and all that last year. But on the ball, he's going to be launching it forward. And we have a lot of that in the team. When you have someone like Bruno Fernandes in there as well, you have almost too much of that. And you want players like Kobbie Mainoo, like Luke Shaw, who I think are two hugely transformational players. And they're also two hugely unique profiles at United. Players who just kind of stop the game for a second and take the sting out of it. and keep you in control. And a lot of times that's when you're talking about when we'd score and go concede in 5 minutes, that's what you're lacking. There's nobody to just stop the game for a minute and say, let's just keep it under control. But wait for this energy to relax.
For an 18-year-old, because those are the things you can't coach. Right, that's that's inherent. That's a personality thing. But having a confidence in yourself, a trust in yourself, to be able to deal with the moment, it's really difficult to do that with a young kid, and especially when you're playing young kids in the middle. You know, I was watching Newcastle at the weekend. They bring on Alex Murphy, young kid, instead of playing at centre back, put him at right back, and United did that with Phil Jones. The middle of the park is where mistakes are most costly. Where if you make them, you're going to get, you know, that's, you give the ball away in the middle of the park, you lose games. To have the composure at 18 to come in and play centrally in a deep line midfield position, and his link-up play was just, I mean, he didn't overcomplicate it. He never looked under pressure, but the variety to his game, because he was able to flange the tackles, that ball kicked off the line, which was as good as a goal at the really, really important time. I was going, oh my God, like it is just, it is, I cannot tell you how good it feels to sit and, I mean, United fans, I'm sure, felt the same thing. You're watching this, you're going, this is just a privilege to watch a kid with that type of football brain. I mean, he was flanning the tackles, he was blocking shots, he was, you know, just, he doesn't have a problem doing the ugly side of the game. Now, he's got a very difficult game coming up against Galatasaray, and I think Ten Hag will pick him, we'll get that in a bit, but I just think, you know, what United have been missing so much in midfield as a player with that type of energy. There was a ball in the second half that he gave down the line to Bruno Fernandes that honestly was just sensational. And Bruno should have done better, in my opinion.
I think it was off the volley, right? Like
he chipped it right down the line. Yeah. Fernandes cuts inside him, like, I mean, just incredible.
Yeah.
You know, and it was everything that he did. You know, you could see we knew they were playing out from the back. All of a sudden, they weren't knocking balls just quickly in their channels and hoping something happens. Absolutely fantastic. And he was really, really encouraging. Other thing I want to ask you is the front line. So you need to pick a front three of Garnacho on the left, Rashford on the right, Martial down the middle. Rashford had a game that looked like a player really short on confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And took his penalty exceptionally well, and hopefully that is something that you know, that helps him and so he can progress, because you can just see it's a confidence issue, you know. But Garnacho on the left, and of course Martial, I was happy to see him score. United need a backup striker that can come in and score goals, so in that sense it was a perfect day, the front three scoring.
Yeah, it was. And obviously prior to this one goal from the front three, Rashford against it was much earlier, Nottingham Forest or something, right? Way earlier in the season. Yeah, that's right. Sorry, at Arsenal. So that was it from the front line, one goal up until this point in time. And 3-1 game certainly makes a difference. And it's what's needed. I mean, it is what is needed. I think, you know, obviously it's similar to what Ten Hag went with against Copenhagen. And before the red card was working really well. Obviously, Højlund was in that game as well. But there's a shift here, obviously, away from using Antony on the right, which I think is something that we've been hoping for some time. And I think it's starting to pay dividends, certainly. I think almost immediately it started paying dividends in what it's done. We've been asking, you know, why don't we get Garnacho and Rashford on at the same time? Just figure it out how to do it, because they're both short on confidence a bit. I mean, it's funny you say that about Garnacho. He has that goal. Outside of that, you know, we saw the last game, he missed some easy chances, same as Rashford. Mm-hmm. They're very short on it. But, you know, those are the types of players who will just do something like that. Garnacho, in a high-pressure situation, scores an incredible goal while not being able to score some of the easy chances. Rashford takes his penalty perfectly, less high pressure, but still a high pressure situation at 1-0 at that point in time. And I think you've got to keep it going. You've got to keep it going. You know, Marcus Rashford, not to get too deep into stat type of stuff, but Marcus Rashford, I think, has something like 5 expected goals in the league, and he scored 2. he's getting in the right spots. You have to get him going. You know, Rasmus Højlund has 3 expected goals in the league and he has 0 goals. You've got to get him going. Garnacho's in a similar situation. These are the players where the goals are going to come from. These are the players where once they're really going, it's 6, 7, 8 more goals than we have now if they were in form and in confidence, you know.
What's interesting, James, is United have scored 7 goals. He scored 4 or 6. He scored 3 away to Everton, 3 away to Copenhagen, and Anthony did not play any of those. Mm-hmm. I don't want to criticize him. I don't think it is the reality.
They will
have a different look up front.
Yeah,
because they, you know, if you look at United's first goal against Copenhagen, the first goal against Everton, it comes from an overlap down the right.
Quickly brought
across. You know, there was
From Rashford to a fullback. Yep.
There was no taking in the corner trying to beat the player, and then or cutting inside and taking a shot. It was quick overlap, boom, ball in the box, goal.
And those are the easy goals, even though it didn't against Everton result in an easy shot. Those are your easy goals. Those are the patterns that good teams do 24/7. That City is going to run 15 times a game. That same pattern, that same play. And it was even the same result against for the chance that you were talking about with Kaby Manu, with Bruno making that run through the right channel and putting him in. And then for the third goal, even with Palestri on the right, same thing. Runs down the right hand side, passes it through to Bruno, puts Martial through. It's not an accident. It isn't an accident. And I'm a big believer in, it's not really a term used in football much, but it is in like American sports, obviously. You know, in basketball, you get a lot of double teams and such on and isolations, and it's talked about a lot more because it's only 5 players and you can see it happen. When Marcus Rashford is there on the left and Antony is on the right, they're giving Antony all the space in the world. And the balance of the defense is very shifted. When you're running Garnacho, who's a threat on the ball running down the wing, and Rashford on the opposite side, you can see the difference that it makes to how the defense is set up, where they cannot guard that extra overlap. They cannot keep throwing extra men to one side. And when you start making those runs through the lines, the chances start piling up. And I'm a big believer in that. You have to have threats. If you're not offering a threat, then defenses are going to start to leave you alone and sag off you. It's like in the NBA, when you got a big guy at the top, he's not going to shoot a 3. Nobody's defending him. Mm-hmm. They're going to let him stand there and they're going to go, you know, create issues. And that's been a huge shift in the whole way that basketball is played, where big men have to shoot 3s now, because otherwise the defense doesn't have to guard them. But point being, it's a lot about threat. And as a team, even if individually some of the players are still struggling, as a team, it's obvious that the extra threat on both sides is making chances happen, is making gaps occur, and is forcing mistakes out of the defense, which is an important aspect as well.
Even if you go back to that Fulham goal, that happens partly because Palestri comes down the right, works really hard to get the ball back, keeps it really simple, right? Doesn't try to overcomplicate it. It keeps it really simple. And, you know, the Martial goal the United scored was great because it was one of the first goals I've seen United score from open play, where you know, it's transitional move into the forward. It was a lovely ball from Bruno. And that in itself was really encouraging. But again, comes from Palestri cutting inside, not cutting inside on his left foot, having a hopeful shot. He was pass the ball quick, turn the ball, move the ball quick, and it was great to see United score from open play.
Yeah, absolutely, it was. And again, I mean, even though we didn't score those goals the last time Rashford was on the right with Højlund in the league, I think Højlund should have scored 2 at that point in that game. He had that one missed from right out. It is making dividends. It's making consistent chances, this setup, and you have to stick with it. Obviously, you can't midweek because Galatasaray, Marcus Rashford being banned for the red card for that game, though he will be back for the final one against Bayern. But I think you go with Palestri in that to kind of bring the same thing, a right-footed player who's going to be able to potentially beat someone for pace. If you watch him for Uruguay, which I have as well quite a bit, he had the same thing during the international break I think you're on mute just in case. But the same thing on the international break, you know, running to the byline, cut back to Nunez, scores a goal. It's the type of goals you want to see, the type of creation you want to see there. So I think that this setup is working, and it is a change that Ten Hag has made that I think he maybe didn't want to make. I know he likes Antony. I know he likes his profile. I know he likes the left-footed player there. But the execution has been so bad that I think we're getting a lot more flexibility out of setting up this way, even though it's not, you know, the usual thing.
That's the first time I've seen United win a game of football where I feel like this may be a moment where something is changing. I mean, I could be wrong. Recording this podcast next week, having lost to Newcastle and lost to Galatasaray, in which case this Everton result would be quickly forgotten. But I felt like this was a confidence builder. I mean, the thing with Rashford's penalty is when you aren't playing well, sometimes the worst thing you can do is take a penalty because you overthink.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's not instinct. It's not just one you swing a leg at and it goes in. You're thinking about all the demons, everything. I guess it takes a lot to be able to compose yourself, and he took that penalty exceptionally well. And then, of course, Martial getting the goal. So Garnacho's goal will give him immense confidence. You know, there's other performances in there that I felt that players can build on. Shaw will obviously help him out a lot. Maguire's performance I thought was exceptional. Onana now feels like a Manchester United goalkeeper.
Yeah.
Wan-Bissaka now coming back. I thought Dal had a decent game. First time in a while he had a decent game. But there just looked to be a much better balance to United's team yesterday that has been missing for so long, where players were played in their best positions. And, you know, I think with the game against Galatasaray coming up, in terms of intense atmospheres, this is as intense as it's going to get. Galatasaray away is going to be extremely difficult. United have a terrible record, though. They've never won.
Right.
They're going to have to go there and win. This is a major test of them. If they can go there and win against Galatasaray, then I really start to believe that United have definitely seen the worst of the season. They're sitting 6 points off Arsenal, which is unbelievable, the top of the league. And the Champions League is still salvageable. I mean, it's not out of the realms of possibility to win the last two games. But there's a big, big game away against a decent side. They're much better at home, obviously. It's not an impossible game, but it's a difficult game. And it's the type of game that if United did go and win, it would have been, I think, you know, really give the team belief that the worst is behind them, but this is a really good game.
Yeah, I think it is. It's a huge game in that respect, because there's not a lot of key games, and so far the key games they've failed the test utterly. Mm-hmm. You know, you can win the games against Everton. It's a big game, mostly played up because of the situation surrounding Everton.
Well, I have to be honest, even if it hadn't happened, I still think it was a difficult game.
Of course. But I mean big in terms of
I still think like that is not like, I mean, I wasn't.
It's always tough.
I was expecting it to lose on Sunday. I agree with what you're saying. I mean, they still have to beat a top nine team. They still have to go away and win a very, very difficult game.
The Champions League games have been poor, already out of the League Cup against Newcastle. You know, they've kind of failed the test in a lot of big games.
But to me, they've got some players back now that gives me reason to think that there's optimism there. Like, you know, Luke Shaw is obviously a big difference. But yes, no, I agree with you. They still have to answer a lot of questions.
For sure. And I think that will be part of the test, is like, it's not just the result, but how they perform in it as well. You know, because you want to see the performances continue to kind of grow, especially on that second half against Everton, where there's composure, where there's patterns, where there's really something building here. And that's where you want to see, where one game to the next, it's not like Jekyll and Hyde, you know, it's not totally different. And that's how you produce, of course, consistent results, is with consistency behind it. It's the same thing with practice. What you practice, what you do every single day, becomes a habit, and you need to see that in game. You want to see those habits in game form, It's still early in the year. The Galats are, I mean, I think this is the biggest game because the game against Bayern is very likely to be a dead rubber for Bayern. And it's at home. So they have a good chance of winning that. I think that's an easier game than this game will be against Galatasaray. So this is a big one. I mean, this is probably the decide. I mean, this is for sure the decider on the Champions League, because if they lose, it's over. If they draw, I think it's over.
They have to go through if they lose. I mean, I mean, it's, they're lucky they're not in a great group, or they would be out already, in my opinion.
Yeah. And the only other thing, obviously, to bring up as a concern, which I think is still a concern, because when you talk about players returning and it making a big difference, the concern I have still is that I don't is this injury issue.
Yeah,
it's not getting better, and I understand these players have returned, but you have a pretty busy December schedule, right? As is always in December. And you don't have that many players available. If you look at the 11 that was fielded yesterday, you look at the bench. I'm not knocking these players, but it's pretty grim. You know, yes, you'll have Rasmus Højlund back pretty shortly, right? You have Wan-Bissaka on the bench, which is good. You have Rafael Varane still on the bench, but I don't know. I don't know when he's going to play. If he's not going to play with Harry Maguire, then you know, it's not much of an option. You only have about, I think, 16 established senior players right now. Mm-hmm. That's it, healthy. You know, and one of those being Kaby Manu, who's had one start, you know, not to say he didn't live up to the test, but he's had one start. And Pelistri, who's had a few starts. That's tough. And when you look at the last few weeks, you have Mason Mount picking up another injury. Antony, even if he's out of form, apparently picked up an injury. As I hear it, there was at least one player in the starting 11 who needed to pass a late fitness test, but that's all right because they did. And then prior to the break, you obviously had Eriksen, Højlund, and Johnny Evans go down all in 1 week.
Listen to this, right? Because I was checking this out. So I was looking at the Premier League injury table because I was – you know, I was watching the Newcastle game at the weekend. They've quite a few injuries too. So United have listed a total of 10 first team players injured. Bournemouth have 7, Brighton have 12, Brentford have 9, Chelsea have 9, Luton have 7, Newcastle have 13, Spurs have 11. So United are sort of in the middle of that table.
I mean, right now,
I'm trying to look at this. I mean, obviously, you're looking at Mount played 9 games for Chelsea last season and going, I don't know, because I mean, lots of clubs are picking up injuries. And I know you get these reports coming out about, you know, Ten Hag's training intensity, but, you know, again, teams, and I've said this many times on this podcast, I go back to Mourinho, Slayton United's medical team, passing players, but they weren't fit. Players then were fit, weren't fit with, you know, Ander Herrera picking up a hamstring injury. When United said he was fit, he wasn't fit. You know, Cavani said he wasn't fit, and they were saying he was fit. You know, Owen Hargreaves had this issue. You know, Mourinho talking about United's, you know, medical equipment. You know, Solskjaer talking about this, Ralph Rangnick talking about this. So, you know, I don't know if I can, I know there's good question marks, but these are the same things that have been happening forever.
Yeah, no, it's a club thing. And my point of bringing it up is it's not really about, like a blame or, you know, to pick on.
No, I know.
It's simply a matter of, like, you know, one of the differences between United's injuries and these other clubs is that over a season, you expect clubs to ramp up on injuries, right? To start pretty healthy. And over time, as the fixtures kind of pile up, the injuries start to build a little bit, especially towards December, January, and then they kind of come back down again. And you kind of get that almost like a peak. The issue with United is that it's been every week since, I think, week two. 2 to 3 injuries every single week since week two. So while right now they have the same number, they've had 10 to 12 first-team injuries practically since the start of the season. Since about week 3 or 4. and they're all muscle injuries. I think Newcastle up in there, they have four or five that are impact injuries. You know, Bentancur came back for Tottenham, went out with an impact injury from a tackle. It is an issue when it just keeps happening over and over, the same type of injuries. And some of it is, of course, a big part of it, a huge part of it, to be clear. There's all these different factors when you come into it, right? If you were to pick different things, you'd say, well, there's the busyness of the schedule, which is a factor. There's the style of play, which is a factor. There's injury records, and then there's training, and there's things like that. And part of the issue is, okay, if the schedule is too busy, somewhere else has to compensate for that, because it's true, but you can't just power through it and end up with everybody being injured and just ignore that the schedule is busy.
Rangers, an example, said that they don't train through the week, but they've got more injuries than you know.
Yeah. Well, and they should. I would expect them to. It's their first year in Europe. And so there is truth to that too. Like, that's a team that is not used to this level of work. And so now a sudden increase in the amount of workload and the amount of games, they're having injuries. And so you might look at that. And it was interesting because when we brought it up initially, I said that.
Where did West Ham get those injuries last season?
It's a good question, honestly. But this is where you have to look at the clubs and say, somebody is getting it right. Because Man City won a treble. They're playing as many games or as many minutes as anybody nowadays. Well, and they're not picking up these kind of injuries.
James of Man City is that this is a football club that spends millions upon millions and millions, and to have state-of-the-art everything,
it
gives them plus they have a squad that allows them to rotate if they need to without a major drop-off in quality.
100%.
Other clubs 100%. That don't have that ability. You know, Lisa Iron talked about the impact of injuries. When you get injuries on other clubs outside of maybe the top two or three, you just don't have the squad to rotate. Yeah. And so, I don't know what the answer is. I just can't
Me neither.
Down to one thing and say it's this. Whenever, look at Shaw's injury, that was not muscle. Balassi's was it. Martinez's was it. Wan-Bissaka's was it. Casemiro's was it. I know United have had a lot of muscle injuries, long contact injuries too. Like Mason Mount is definitely a concern. Hoyland's a bit of a concern, there's no doubt. And I definitely think there's Johnny Evans was a non-contact injury. You can see why Johnny Evans has gone from, the load completely changing and getting injured. Varane, is typically non-contact. But this is, something that's played at him for a while. And, Eriksen's was, I don't know if it was non-contact or not with that slip. I can't. I don't know. I'm looking at Newcastle at the weekend. Joe Linton was down after a couple of minutes. The players falling, they're constantly injured and going. Eddie High. They've had the transition to European football too. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to pin it down on one thing.
Yeah. It is. And apparently they do pretty intense training as well. But I think the matter of it is that it's hard to pin the answer on it, but there should be an answer and they should be able to figure out an answer. And I'm not talking about the manager or a coach or something like that, but the club should have an answer for these types of things, because it's not going to get any easier. And that's where the reason I don't like accepting the excuses of it from a football club standpoint is you have to, again, it's like recruitment. It's like the failures with managers, with sacking them, with hiring new ones. They have to know why this is happening. If they cannot identify why this is happening, then it's not going to get better. Then they cannot fix it. Because the schedule is going to get busier. When this new Champions League format comes in, the new Club World Cup comes in, you're getting a busier schedule over the next few years. And so it's not going away. So we cannot, I think as a club, they cannot say it's just bad luck and we just have to power through it. You've got to figure out an answer to it somehow.
No, I agree. You've got to make sure that you invest every resource possible to minimize these. Yep. I think one of the other things was listening to club doctors talk about this, and they were saying clubs that have a lot of young players, young players are far more prone to non-contact injuries. So you look at Brighton. You know, Brighton have a lot of young players because the way their body develops. And so, you know, obviously Manu's and Mamad's weren't on contact, but, you know, but I think when you have young players that are still growing physically, you know, and I think plus young players tend not to be as disciplined off the field, where they're not a constant. I mean, even Garnacho, you could see United yesterday were trying to, you know, not let him get carried away with what happened, because go through this. I don't know, but there's also not a very well defined threshold between what is too much and what isn't. And totally. I think part of the problem is these kids just play so much football. You know, in internationals, and they're, you know, constantly playing football. There's way too much, and there is no proper rest and recuperation. But yeah, it's definitely something United need to do better at. The other thing I want to mention, James, is John Murta has been heavily criticized by United fans. Legitimate criticism has been leveled at him. Now, this is a guy that is a United director of football in title. But John Murta deserves credit for Garnacho. John Murta deserves credit for Kaby Mainoo, right? John Murta deserves credit for some of the young players that we're seeing, you know, the first team today that weren't there. This United won the Youth Cup a couple of years ago. That weren't there, you know, that a youth team that was gutted and decayed, you know, finally reinvested in it a few years ago. And I think that, you know, I obviously any of us are going to come in bringing their own people.
Yeah.
I know, but maybe if they keep Murta on in another capacity, in another job that allows him to focus on maybe youth development, recruitment, or something like that, in a position where he's actually legitimized and where he's given proper support and not disenfranchised, but I think he deserves some credit for some of what we're seeing at the moment.
Yeah, I would agree. He does. And, you know, I've said a lot of nice things about John Murta in the past. And one of the things I've also mentioned many times that I think is true is it is very hard to judge the director or whoever is dealing with transfers for the senior team at United under the current setup. It's nearly impossible because of the amount of interference that is in there, because of the pressures, because of the decisions that come from elsewhere in terms of how it's set up. You have no real idea who's making the decision actually at the end of the day, and who's responsible for it, because it is not set up that way. And that doesn't mean that John Murta's done a great job with senior recruitment. It's sort of like you can't really judge it either way. And Ineos coming in, they're likely going to do their own. The recruitment's been poor. Who's to blame for it? I mean, primarily it still goes all the way back to the top, to Joel Glazer. It's been consistent prior to John Murta, prior to Richard Arnold, prior to Erik ten Hag. The recruitment has been poor for ages, and it's never really been set up to be successful. John Murta has done really well in two major areas. One of them, the youth setup, as you mentioned, where it's actually felt that the crop of players coming through, even at the younger ages right now, is far superior than to anything that United have had in a long time. And I mean, like the next generation of youth players coming through is excellent and is fantastic. And the other area is the women's team too. It was really a big part of getting it really going and off the ground and set up and moving to where, you know, it needs a lot more. But they've made pretty good progress considering the newness of the whole thing and in terms of putting the time, money, and effort into it. And one of the interesting things I will say about that is, as far as I get it, it may not be the case right this moment, especially in the transition from youth to senior squads, youth to senior contracts and things like that. But a lot of the youth stuff that was done under John Murta was done without as much oversight. And what I mean by that is, not every signing, not every contract, not every move was being pushed up to being made the decisions by someone else, because how could they, right? How could, you know, Joel Glazer could say, I watch players and I've got people and things like that and have influence on it. But when you're talking about the signings of youth players and things, it's not really the same. And from how I understand it, it was run more of its own unit. Like it's kind of like you kind of want a football department to be run where it had its own budget and it could just make its own decisions, and it's done really well. in that respect. I think it's actually improved a lot. And so I think it's an area where, yeah, if a new director came in and you said, okay, you know, Murtagh, you're going to be deputy director or something like that, that you call it. We want you overseeing the academy, the women's team. I'd be happy. Yeah. I would say, I think he's got a good track record there. Yeah. And I think he's actually had a lot of success and deserves credit for those things. I would be quite happy with that. You would not see a complaint from me about that at all. So I think that is definitely the case. And again, it still also comes back to just the difficulties of judging at United, who's doing a job. We take the same thing I bring up with the injuries and Ten Hag and all that. It's hard to judge Ten Hag as a manager right now because there's so many other factors involved. You know, we don't know how we'd be doing with a settled team. We don't know how we'd be doing if recruitment had been run differently the last few years. We don't know, frankly. And so it's hard. You don't always want to put the blame too directly on anybody involved in this process. And that includes Murtagh as well. Until things are set up the way that they're set up and decisions are made in the right way that they're supposed to be made, it's hard to say that, but you can give them credit for that academy and the women's team as well, which I think deserves more and more investment. And one thing I wanted to bring up before I forget on this, as it relates to the academy, is there's an interesting kind of debate that goes on between fans watching teams about young players and trusting them and kind of throwing them in the deep end versus protecting them. And it's real interesting because I think we've seen a lot more success, and I don't think we're the only club that have seen it this way. We've seen a lot more success kind of throwing these players in the deep end than we have spending too long protecting them to where they end up, in a lot of instances, never even making it onto the pitch for the long term. You look at Marcus Rashford, he came through because of an injury crisis and kind of grabbed it with both hands. Kobbie Mainoo comes in because we need him right now and grabs it with both hands. Alejandro Garnacho pretty much came in the same way. I mean, it was all of a sudden. It wasn't like an emergency, but it was all of a sudden and came in and just went for it and been trusted to do that. And McTominay in the same way for Jose Mourinho. But you've seen that where you've seen the players that are sort of protected. You try to ease them in that end up never making it, where they got a few minutes in some competitions here and there. Players like Angel Gomez, James Garner, these types of players. I'm not saying they were good enough, but they really never got a chance in the end. And I've seen that at other clubs. You're seeing this a lot more now. You're seeing it at like Newcastle. They just throw a player, young player in there. Liverpool have done it with some of their players. Arsenal have done it. City have done it even with a couple of players. There's a player at PSG, 17 years old, who's come in and just been kind of incredible off the bat. Barcelona have been doing it for years now. And I think that it's kind of a shift to where obviously having a settled environment at United would help, a settled team would help in tossing these players in. But I think there's something to be said for these young players to say they're kind of either going to sink or swim. I can't think of that many players who've been brought through so carefully and then turned into long-term players for big clubs over the years. I really can't think of that many. I think much more of them, even going back to the class of 92, way back then, have come through just by kind of ending up in the deep end and sinking or swimming. And the ones that swim, because mentality has so much to do with it as well. Can they raise that level mentally even from a young age? And I'm not saying they should be your number one guy right off the bat every game, but you kind of get more results from just stepping the standards up for them and seeing what they could do.
I think the kids that get thrown in where they're not loaned out are the ones that are truly outstanding talents.
Yeah.
Where you're going, the ones that they're trying to ease in are the ones that maybe aren't as obvious, and they're trying to see how they develop. They get loaned out and they hope they progress, but you know, the Gavis and the Pedris are such exceptional talents that it's obvious they should be integrated. You know, United didn't loan out Kobbie Mainoo because I think they knew, you know, you saw Ten Hag with Kobbie Mainoo on the pitch last season after the League Cup final, having a long talk him on the field. I think it's very difficult, especially with City's academy, really gobbling up any decent player in Manchester now. To get those young players at United now, it's only a renewed focus that's got that. And there's still, a million Josh Harrops, there's still a million, Andres Pereiras and stuff that just, if you speak to people, I've spoke to people that work at Premier League clubs, and they will tell you that gap between under 23 football and Premier League football is absolutely enormous. And so for some kids, they go down to the Championship, they develop other attributes. The Championship's an exceptionally good league that allows them, to progress. I mean, Harry Kane and stuff went down there. But for a lot of the players, it's a massive jump. Pressure is enormous. I remember, when Real Madrid had this Zidane and Pavons route, where Carlos Queiroz was told, we'll bring in 4 or 5 of the world's best players and we'll mix them with players from the academy. And he had just come from United's academy and said, the problem is with that, the probability that you're going to have the best left back in the world and then the best centre midfield in the world, the best right fielder. If you want to win, the biggest trophies in the world, you have to be looking for the best players in each position that you can have to get your hands on. The probability they're in your academy is not high. And I still think that you can have a mix of, it doesn't have to be the best left back in the world, but they bring different attributes. I mean, some of the players that came through United's academy weren't the best in the world in the season. But Gary Neville wasn't the best right back in the world, but was still very, very important. John O'Jay wasn't the best centre back in the world, but still was important because of his attitude, because of his flexibility. So I accept that that it's not always about being the best player in the world in the season, but I think this is what makes when a young player comes through so exceptional, is because it's, if you speak to youth coaches, one of the things they'll tell you is, we don't want the best under 18 team. We want 2 or 3 players in that group that have the potential to meet the first team, right? Because that's really what our job is.
Yeah, that's what you're doing. Yeah.
Players. If we can be a great team, fine, that's a bonus. But if you get 1 or 2 kids out of each group that has the potential to meet the first team, that is... And it's harder and harder in the Premier League because the level is so much higher. I mean, if United had the class of 92 coming through now, I don't know if they'd win a league that way.
I hear you.
So it is very, very difficult. There are so many young players that have tremendous potential at 17, 18, that by 23, they're gone. I think of so many of them And development is funny. Like, Scott McTominay went from 5'8" to 6'4" at 18, he had this massive growth spurt. You could see kids at enormous potential at 18, like Angel Gomez, playing for United at 16, 17, which is truly unbelievable. Go into other leagues, from Portugal, France and everything, and it just, that development stalls. It's really strange how the physiological, the mental development, the technical development, Harry Kane's a perfect example. What was he, 21? He was sitting on Millwall. And all of a sudden he's the best striker in the world. And, it's really unpredictable that way. But I think United probably do this better than any top club in England in giving young players a chance. And if you're good enough, United will give you that chance. So I love that they do that. But it's
me too.
I hope they never get away from.
Yeah, and I think for me, it's something when I look at the patterns, I'm less worried about the discussion around protecting them and things like that, because I can't see that it's really gone that bad. It's not like there's players who've come into United, failed that mentality test as a youth player where it was too big for them and then gone on to become superstars somewhere else. It doesn't happen.
I think part of our problem, James, is with today. I mean, we just talked about Ten Hag, and I think he's a perfect example. A month ago he's being ridiculed in comparison to Ange Postecoglou, who now is 2 points behind Postecoglou. The problem is the praise and the criticism goes too far. Yeah. You know, when they do well, the praise is off the charts, the criticism is off the charts. And this is part of the problem with social media now, is that when you look at players like Dele Alli, and there's going to be thousands of Dele Allis, you know, that the pressure that these young players are under is truly immense. It's unlike any era we've ever lived in, where these kids are not allowed to make mistakes. You know, these Garnacho may be getting suspended because of a social media post. You know, these are things that the pressure, especially the top club, you know, is they're dealing with things that in the past they never had. I mean, Lee Sharp and Ryan Giggs had house parties. They were up to all kinds of stuff. Ronaldo Anderson was up to all kinds of stuff. Nani, but now these kids don't have that anonymity anymore. And I get what you're saying because, you know, look, I think the truly outstanding players, you know, they get their chance. Sometimes they take it, sometimes they don't. But I think I remember when United were asked to play a youth team in the FA Cup third round in 99, instead of going when they went to the Club World Cup, and Ferguson refused to do it because he said, I'm in the process of building careers with young players. The quality gets into a club like United. The part you're not sure about is the mental part of it. Is how do they handle the moment of that type of pressure? And this is why they try to get them out to other clubs so that they can develop, become more mentally mature, make mistakes away from that spotlight so that they, you know, don't get ruined. And I mean, I think you only need to look at people like Mason Greenwood to see that you have this immense talent and you press a self-destruct button, you know? So I don't know what the right answer that is. I think you have to tell, depends on the kid, depends on who they're surrounded by, what their background is and all that, because, you know, a lot of these young players are surrounded by idiots.
You know? No doubt about that, unfortunately.
It's other thing is, before we go, you know, United have been scouting heavily at the under-17 World Cup. I know they really like the River Plate kid, Echeverri. I spoke to an individual who works with United, who told me that they had given United a number of scouting reports on him. He's a young Argentinian kid. I believe he plays for River Plate. Very, very, very good kid. I know that they also like Estevao, which has been nicknamed the Messinho. He scored 3 and 4 games at the under-17 World Cup. This is a market United have been neglectful of for years, that I assume this is at the, you know, at the direction of Ineos. I know we talked about this briefly on podcast last week about Ineos. I don't know when it's going to be announced, but I'm just telling you that the people that are connected to this are certain that this is already done. You know, so I've never had that degree of certainty from talking to these people. There's always been a caveat. Maybe. But speaking to the people that would know have told me that you know, that's their understanding. But yeah, I would imagine that their focus is on trying to recruit better that age group.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the way to describe it, if you've ever bought a house, you go through the negotiations, you go through the offers, you get things accepted, you get the paperwork done, you wait a month for closing.
It's annoying.
I know. It's just so, but it's like that, you know, you're sitting there, you're waiting, you're like, all right, well, closing's going to be in 3 weeks, 4 weeks, something like that, because there's underwriting, there's all the legal that goes through it. There's the checks, there's the tests, there's all these things that have to go through. There's a whole mess of regulations when it comes, especially to United. This is different to the sale of Chelsea, of course, because Chelsea not being publicly listed on the New York Stock Exchange makes things a lot more complicated. If the club was not publicly listed on the New York Stock Exchange, they could announce an agreement well before it's done. They could announce the sale well before every single I is dotted and T is crossed, because it would have no real material effect on things. As it were, it's pretty much got to be done the moment it is done. Officially, they kind of can't say anything for it. There was a short interview with somebody did that I listened with Colette Roche from United, where she said basically the same thing, which is that's the issue. Whatever is happening, they cannot say anything about it because it's ongoing. So it could be done, agreed. It's not like a transfer where, you know, you're going to brief out, oh, a fee's agreed and everything's ready and we're just waiting on the medical for the next couple of weeks because it has such a material effect on it. But it is essentially like waiting for closing at this point in time. For the people who are involved in negotiating, their job is done. For the people who are involved in making an agreement, their job is done. It's about the it's little logistics and the things that can take time, unfortunately. That's the way that it's been pressed. I haven't heard any reason why it shouldn't be this week at this point in time, as of today. I know it's like as of today, yeah. But you know, come Thursday, is someone going to say, well, it's taking a little longer, it might be next week? Maybe.
At this point, it would be a major shock if it didn't happen. You know, it would be like, what type of,
yeah,
you know, unbelievable, you know, scenario and happened behind the scenes that made this not happen. But I mean, look, yeah.
One could say like, well, that's the Glazers or something, but it's really not. That's as far as their business track record goes, they're not really the type of people to make these types of deals and have them fall through. Actually, they've done a lot of business dealings over the years through the US. It's not like exactly like that. Type of thing. So everybody involved is fine. And to the point, like I think I mentioned it in a video last week, because I found out after a podcast, but you know, certain people, highly influential people at INEOS at the top are, you know, they're on vacation. They're not in the middle of like brutal negotiations over the final details of these types of things. It's nothing like that. I just can only preach some patience. And even still, of course, afterwards, I know we all wanted to announce we could put that part of that yeah, tiny hinge of like, we just want this thing announced. Mm. The positive is, as I understand it, once it is announced, it will come with specific statements. It will come with information about how it's actually going to work. And it will come with something about the long-term path to majority ownership. I'm not saying they're even 100% that means there is one, because I don't know 100% on that. But as I understand it, there will be something about it. So
no, there needs to be.
I'd be surprised if it was to say there's no path to ownership, because that wouldn't really make sense with the way it was communicated to me. But there will be some clarification over that as well. And so I think we're going to get all of our questions answered, but unfortunately they cannot be answered because of the nature of this deal and the New York Stock Exchange and all that, until it is officially announced. So it's going to take a little bit, hopefully not much more waiting, hopefully tomorrow. I mean, it could be as early as tomorrow, you know.
Yeah, well, hopefully, I took last week off, so stopped asking about it, but I did ask on the Monday before I left about it, and I was assured that it was all, you know, that there was nothing left to do.
Yep.
So I assume it's just a bit of approval from the regulatory process, but I don't know. I haven't asked. But all right, mate, we'll leave it there. Hopefully by the next time we record this, we are not back in Doomland.
We've got two huge games. So, I mean, the crazy part about it is on Monday when we record this, we could be in fifth, which could be, of course, a Champions League position this year. With the changes to the qualification and all that, and having beaten Galatasaray, or it could be very messy. So let's hope for the best.
Beat Galatasaray, took a draw at Newcastle, I would be delighted.
Oh, yeah. I'd be quite happy.
Delighted with that. I think it would be a fantastic result. And it'd be interesting to see who United's front three is with no Rashford. Hoyland will be back. So I wonder how he's going to line up.
Could we get Martial and Hoyland together with Martial in two games in the week? I know.
Be risky, but yeah, I mean, by the way, what was Anthony yesterday?
Had a knock in training, apparently. So they say.
All right, mate. I'll talk to you later. Have a good week. Have a good week. Yep. Thanks, folks, for all downloads.
Thanks, everybody.
Tweets all that. Much appreciated. Take it easy.